Welcome to the Evolved Caveman Podcast. I am Dr. John, the guide for your heroic journey towards greater health, success, and most importantly, happiness. And now, on with the show. Hi, this is Dr. John, and I am thrilled to announce that Jory and I are opening up our retreat in beautiful Costa Rica from September 28th of 2024 to October 5th. Everyone wants fulfilling relationships. The hard part is love is not enough. So many factors can get in the way, preventing ongoing connection, intimacy, and aligned growth. All healthy relationships start within. But when we have unresolved stuff, it can easily interfere with those we are seeking to be closest with. Whether you're in a long-term committed partnership or are single and are looking for love, this retreat will guide you in the heroic journey of healing yourself so that you can be open and available to cultivate the fulfilling relationships you desire and deserve. To find out more, visit joriroese.com/retreats. That's joriereroese.com/retreats. Hey, everybody. This is Dr. John back with the latest episode of the Evolved Caveman Podcast. And we are doing a joint podcast today with Journey Forward with Jory Rose.
Hey, everyone. We are so happy to be back talking about something that we see so many couples struggle with, which is the anxious avoidant trap. And fortunately and unfortunately, we've got some good experience about this in our own relationship. So we have a deep understanding of what this looks like from the inside out in a relationship. But the good news is, not only are we going to share some important information about what kind of leads to this dance in a relationship, but give you some really solid advice and tools on how to get out of it. Because John and I in our relationship used to get stuck in this dance. And I am so grateful to say, with our own awareness and insight into what was going on, we have learned how to no longer dance the dance of the anxious and avoidant.
And I just want to say that it's one of the most common dynamics that we see in relationship and one of the most difficult, because the two attachment styles, avoidant and anxious, are antithetical to one another. In other words, they're almost like polar opposites. And so it creates a very difficult and painful dynamic in these relationships.
So what's important to understand, that the root of this is attachment styles. So I'm going to give a brief overview. I'm certain many people have heard about the different attachment styles, and there's three main different styles. The first one is secure attachment. And this is generally how a baby under age two is developing a bond with a primary caregiver. Generally, it's the mother. So the goal and the ideal situation is a secure attachment. So that means baby's job is to go explore the world and go play. They are able to do so better when they come back and their mom is still there. That gives them a sense of security and safety, but it also wires their brain for what love looks like and how to trust others. So when I go off and explore, I trust my person, which later becomes our primary partners, is going to be there for us. I feel safe. I feel secure. That's the ideal. The anxious style comes from when baby goes off to explore and play explore the world and play. When they come back, sometimes mom is there, sometimes they're not. Hence, anxiety. They don't know what they're going to get. And that also wires their brain for not trusting others can be there for them. The avoidant style is, again, baby goes off to wander and play. When they come back, primary caregiver is generally not available. Even if they're present, not available for them. That wires their brain for really not trusting others, but really wiring them to become self-reliant. The message they learn is, I can't rely on others to be there for me, so I better learn how to take care of myself and figure this out. So you can see, and then there's also an anxious avoidant mix, but keeping it simple as the three main attachment styles. The good news is our attachment styles aren't fixed. So even if you had an anxious attachment with your mother as a child, you can have a really healthy partnership. So it's really relationship dependent. And we all have that core narrative, even if it changes at the current relationship, we do have that core experience from early childhood, which does a good job of wiring our brain. Good news is our brains can change, but we've got to let our belief systems catch up with what we know science can do for our brain. So that being said, when couples get into difficult dynamics with one another, it can activate their attachment styles. John, do you want to share a little bit more what that might look like in practice or in actuality?
Sure. For couples? So the anxious avoidant trap or conflict is, as I said, the most common one. And at their base, an anxious attachment style is generally tending towards the relationship. They want connection. When they don't get connection, they get afraid, they get panicked, they get anxious. The avoidant attachment.
Can I just add one thing in there?
Yeah.
That anxious attachment, at the very root, I forgot to say this in my little intro that I was talking about. At the very root, what we feel when we are back with that primary caregiver is a sense of regulation. So we're always seeking a way to be regulated. And just to add on to what you said, the anxious person is going to find regulation with their partner. Whereas, and I'll lead you back into what you were going to say.
So the avoidant is generally tending away. They're turning away from the relationship. They're pulling away from. And the reason for that is generally they're trying to find a way to regulate their nervous system, a way to calm themselves down, which they do solo. And the anxious person does it in relationship, in tandem. And so you can see where this creates a lot of problems. So when Jory and I first started going out, everything was hunky-dory, like it was fantastic. And then, you know, we start having a few arguments here and there. And what would happen, we found, is that usually I would disappoint Jory in some way, which I hate to do. And we would get into a disagreement about it. And I can hang with it for about 15 minutes or so. And then I found myself getting emotionally flooded. So my parasympathetic nervous system turns off, my sympathetic nervous system turns on. That's the fight, flight, freeze response, the stress response. And then I'm kind of useless for thinking clearly, because then my actions are limited to fight, flight, freeze, but so are my thoughts. And so my response to that internally was, I'm just not going to say anything because I don't want to say anything in anger that's going to hurt Jory. The problem with that is, from Jory's perspective,
it felt like abandonment.
And it's stonewalling.
And it was deeply disconnecting. And the more I felt disconnected, the more I sought connection and I would step towards, which would in turn make John feel fearful of not being able to meet my need of connection. So he would withdraw further. So you can see where this dynamic is like this chase that never gets resolved. And the anxious person feels unseen and unvalidated in their needs to connect. And the avoidant person feels unseen and invalidated for their need for space. Mm-hmm. It's really a challenging dynamic. And I don't think it could always stem from you disappointing me in those dynamics. And it might have been something going on with your inner self that might have been an inner trigger that just caused you to need space. But when we don't have the language to name what's going on, it can feel really dysregulating for the couple overall.
This dynamic even would come into play. Like, we got to the point where I could say, hey, sweetheart, I need a break. I'm getting flooded. And even that wasn't enough to calm you. Because you thought I was leaving the relationship.
Right.
And so I tried to work in, you know, and I'll be back. But we found that still wasn't enough also.
Well, and I think part of that was there were prior times in which you had tried to leave the relationship. So my safety in trusting mm-hmm. those words wasn't really solid. And I know now, looking back, that it was you attempting to seek safety from fear of being hurt or hurting me, that it was mm-hmm. really an insecurity around trusting in relationship, period, than it was about not wanting to be in relationship with me. And we do know from the research with John and Julie Gottman that naming the specific amount of time you're going to need space for the avoidant person to reassure the anxious person is really key. Because you would say, I would be back, but I don't know how long that meant. Mm-hmm. That was a challenge. And the research says that a minimum of 20 minutes, but a maximum of 24 hours. But the key is to tell the other person, hey, I need 20 minutes. And if you still need another 20, come back and then be able to name, I'm not quite regulated yet. And
well, so let me throw something out there though, in the sense that what if a couple has a conversation like this about it, they discover, oh yeah, that anxious avoidant trap, that's what we're in. And what if they agree when they're calm, hey, look, anyone can take a timeout, with the caveat that when we take a timeout, it's a minimum of 20 minutes and a maximum of 24 hours. So that maybe, because I know at times when I was flooded, it was hard to even get to that point of I'll be back in fill in the blank X hours, 4 hours, because I don't really know.
Right. Well, yeah. And sometimes you were very fixed mindset around this may never work based on other narratives of mm-hmm. worthiness in relationship. I'm not even sure you always knew when you would be back.
Right.
And, you know, this, you know, for the work that John and I are building in our Love Isn't Enough masterclass series and our Love Isn't Enough coaching, this really speaks to some deeper curiosities around what is the responsibility of the relationship work versus what is the self work, right? Because what we're guiding our clients in together with Love Isn't Enough is that constant interplay of the self work as well as the relational. And this anxious avoidant trap is a perfect microcosm of the self and others, or the other being the relational work, ongoing interplay. Because while you were taking the space to regulate your nervous system from feeling flooded and overwhelmed by emotion so you could calm yourself down, because you would even say, I don't want to say something, anything that would hurt you. Mm-hmm. And the reason, if you guys are new to the podcast or new to any of our teachings, I always like to give this education about our brain, is in the center part of our brain, we have our emotional brain. And in the front above our eyes is our prefrontal cortex, which is our most evolved part of the brain. That's where we have logic, reason, rationality, decision-making, clear thinking, language, communication. So when the emotional brain fires off, it literally cuts off access to that executive functioning. So if this is why this is a really important key in understanding when you're arguing with your partner, the self-awareness to know when you are flooded, that conversation's not going to be effective because you're operating from your emotional brain and you're cut off from logic, reason, rationality, and communication. So a timeout really is an effective tool for arguing so that we can get our executive functioning back online. It's like the Wi-Fi has gone out.
Yeah. And when you're in that state, if I may, you have a lot of cognitive errors. So as I said, your thinking is fight, flight, freeze, along with your behaviors. But that leads to things like all or nothing thinking, black or white thinking, overgeneralizations, emotional reasoning, and so forth. So you're going to say things that may not even make sense, you know, like, oh, you never do this.
I always
do this. Like, never and always statements are never true.
Are they all?
Well, think about that for a while. I don't know.
That's kind of a meta thing there. But the key that we're, you know, I think was really helpful, and I'll get back to what I started to say a moment ago, what the self work is in this, is at the very root of all disagreement. I mean, we did a podcast episode recently on arguing effectively, right? And the best way we can argue effectively is to get that emotional brain to calm down, to get all that executive functioning back online so we can access those resources. And the best way to do that is to give ourselves the space to breathe and to regulate. Now, for me, in those moments, when you would take your space and you would say, I need to go calm down. So in my perfect mind, I should have been able to respect the fact of, oh, he's needing to go regulate right now, so that he's available to communicate and to connect with me. But my anxious mind couldn't tolerate the space. And it felt more triggering. And that's because I had an underdeveloped sense of self-regulation. So what I had to learn in those dynamics was, okay, when John needs space, because he is a little bit stuck in that avoidance style and doesn't yet trust the safety of relationship, I need to learn to trust myself to regulate my own nervous system. I was over-reliant, hence the anxiety. I was over-reliant on you to regulate that for me. So it was deep work for me in those moments to be like, ah, shit, I got to self-regulate here and that feels really uncomfortable. I don't like being alone right now. I want my partner to comfort me and reassure me. He's not available for that. What can I do? And at the very root is we sit and we breathe. That's going to be the core of what's going to regulate that nervous system, calm down that emotional brain, and find what self-care looks like for me in those moments. And I can think of two moments in particular, one in which we were in Italy when we struggled with this dynamic, unfortunately, a lot in one of the most beautiful places in the world in Lake Como. And what was powerful about that was I didn't over-personalize your need for space. And I'm like, oh, I can go for a walk right now. Mm-hmm. And I ended up going for a walk and I felt empowered by choosing me to go on a walk versus you saying, I'm like, I think I was the first one in that moment to say, I'm going to go for a walk. So it felt like I had agency in the space. And I ended up going on this beautiful walk and I sat by the lake and I ordered myself a glass of champagne. And I just like, this is great self-care right now.
You know, you bring up an interesting point in the sense of, I wonder if people that are in the anxious avoidant trap, if it's possible for the anxious person to realize their partner's getting shut down and for them to request a timeout and for them to choose to go elsewhere with the knowledge that they'll be back soon to resolve things. Because I think there's something in the choice and the autonomy for the anxious person of being like, okay, this is my choice. Not he's leaving me.
Yeah. I'm going to get really, really vulnerable with you guys right now as we're recording this. So this morning I was over John's and we had a bit of a disconnect and I was going to plan on staying at his place the rest of the day. And guess what I did? I said, hey, I think I'm going to go home for a few hours. I'll be back later tonight. So I actually enacted that choice. And it wasn't a huge anxious avoidant trap dance mm-hmm. issue. It was, I think John would be better having some space alone right now. I'm going to go home and I'll be back later. So I actually did that today.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, and you did it well.
And I know it was helpful and I didn't over-personalize
it. And I appreciated it.
I know he needs some space right now. He's exhausted. He's a little bit emotionally overwhelmed. And the best thing I can do for him to be able to meet my needs is to give him that space. Now, I'm able to do that much better now because we have quite secure attachment. We've worked on this. So this isn't like an easy thing to enact when you are still in the middle of that dance. But I had to really learn as the anxious attachment style, A, even if he doesn't come back, I'm going to be okay. Like fundamentally, and we had a breakup and that fucking sucked. And I had to start to learn I can be okay even without him. I didn't like it. I don't want that. And I had to find that regulation within myself. But taking that walk in Lake Como and sitting by the lake and getting a glass of champagne felt like a great self-care for me in the moment. And I remember another time we were stuck in this dance and we were going to have dinner and you needed space. And it was like now 10 o'clock at night and I hadn't eaten dinner. And I called my friend and I was upset and I was crying to her. And she's like, well, what do you feel you need right now? And like through my tears, I'm like, I want an In-N-Out burger. And she's like, great, go to In-N-Out. So I grabbed the dog, got in the car. It was like 11 o'clock. But again, that was kind of new to me. It seems so obvious and it almost feels slightly embarrassing now to feel how unevolved emotionally that was. And that was my work.
Yeah, but I would say champagne and In-N-Out are pretty good, you know,
yeah,
routes to self-care and calming down.
Yeah, I think so. And not that we need to turn to food and alcohol, but hey, you know what works for you. And so that was a deep level of self-work for me to recognize, okay, he still loves me. He's overwhelmed. I have a need. He has a need. He cannot meet my need right now. The more I push it, the further he's going to need more space. It actually behooves me to give him the space quicker without putting my claws on him and dragging him back, because that's never going to work, you guys. Even though it feels desperate. And yet it was very humbling to say, oh, this actually isn't about me. Because where he's coming from is rooted in his childhood, in which he had an avoidant attachment style, in which he learned self-reliance was the safest thing. Partnership mm-hmm. was the safest thing.
Yeah.
And when I can have compassion for that rather than judge it or overpersonalize it, then we can begin to have the ability to build secure attachment.
And I would say that in general, if I had to guess, I would say that in this dynamic, usually the avoidant is going to be male, the anxious is going to be female.
Right.
And part of it is because we're socialized as men to believe we need to stand on our own and to be independent. And we're often, I think mothers kind of let us go in terms of attention and support earlier.
Right.
I know that, you know, that was true for me, that I was pretty on my own emotionally and relationally growing up. But let me go on to what I had to, my individual work, because I think it's fascinating to think of, you know, there's this relational element to this, which we took to the limit in terms of improving communication, kind of getting our communication down. And then there's this individual element,
big piece of that,
that I think we needed to go deeper than the typical couple's tools would take us. And that was kind of eye-opening for us. So you needed to learn better self-soothing techniques. I, interestingly, needed to I found that when I was getting flooded and we were in disagreement, there was times, and it wouldn't last long, but long enough to do damage, where I would hear thoughts such as, she'd be better off without me, or I'm no good at this relationship thing. And it took a while of kind of thinking about that. It took a while to even be aware of it, because if you had asked me 10 years ago if I felt any shame, I would have said, no, don't be ridiculous. But all of a sudden, I was like, holy shit, that's shame. Those thoughts tell me that I was feeling shame, because what is shame but the belief that I am unworthy of love, connection, and belonging? So those thoughts are kind of the epitome of shame. And so once I realized that, I was like, oh, okay, so at some deep level, this is about self-worth, worthiness in relationship, worthiness to connect. And so what I did then was kind of get into internal family systems and then start having some conversations with little John, with the four-year-old John that was left alone at times, with a babysitter, but, you know, for long periods of time. And I had to tell him that he was safe. He was okay. He was loved. He was valued. He's worthy. And then, you know, beyond that, to go take a nap when we're in these disagreements so that, you know, wise adult John can respond more appropriately. But that took a few conversations in an attempt to deal with that shame, so that that shame didn't come up as intensely or as frequently in those situations.
And another component of this that was really eye-opening too was recognizing, what is the difference between me having an anxious response in that anxious avoidant dance versus me having a trauma response? And this was a huge awareness. Can you share what shifted for you when we had this awareness? Because sometimes my anxiety felt disproportionate, and I think that frustrated you and it made you feel, well, you can share what it made you feel, but it felt disproportionate to the situation. And yet all I know is I was getting hyper dysregulated in a way that didn't even feel like I was within my body at times. And it felt really embarrassing because I'm a pretty emotionally stable person normally, and this just didn't feel like me.
Mm-hmm.
It was significant.
Well, I think that's one of the interesting things about romantic relationships is they bring up this stuff that nobody else sees. And I think it's, you know, there are pieces of ourselves which we are embarrassed by or ashamed by or feel guilty about that only our romantic partner sees in these worst moments. And they may only happen 2-5% of the time, but they can damage relationships, destroy them potentially. So what we realized was that this wasn't just an anxious attachment style that you were having. This was a trauma response to some things that happened in your early childhood. And I really like that line. I think it's by Terry Real, that the idea is, if it's hysterical, it's historical. Mm-hmm. And I think to some extent, we were both having hysterical reactions. Like, in other words, hysterical meaning that the emotional response was out of proportion with the situation. Right. And you know, those situations where you're like, what was that? Like, where did that come from? Why did I feel so strongly about that? And then, of course, you know, the first thing we typically want to do is blame our partner for our intense emotional reaction. When I think a much better response is to look at, wow, that was way out of proportion. I wonder what I can connect that with in my past. And now it could be a past relationship, could be childhood. But it generally indicates that there's something more going on beneath the surface. So anyway, once we figured out that this was a traumatic response, not merely an anxious attachment style, which says to me that it's a higher emotional intensity on the scale, but it helped me have great compassion for where you were coming from. And it helped me to get out of my own anger and hurt in those disagreements. Mm-hmm. I don't know about 100% of the time, but much more frequently.
Well, and
because I could access this idea of, oh shit, this is a trauma response from Jory. I need to help her regulate.
Right. And not all of my anxious responses were trauma responses. I don't want to give permission to just say it was always trauma and you should have been there no matter what. And, you know, put my needs first. And I think there were certain times that definitely was the case. And I used to struggle because it felt like the avoidant need for space superseded my anxious need for connection.
Well, and I was going to say that I think it brings up this interesting conundrum or problem where when we're in disagreement in romantic relationships, we often want our emotional needs to be addressed first. Mm-hmm. Because they're so close to home and they hurt so much. But if you both want your emotional needs to be addressed first, who actually gets their needs met first?
Right. And then it goes back to another Terry Real line of, do you want to be right or do you want to be connected? And by right, I mean, who's going to win this battle? Right. Yeah. And again, when you're in this state, your emotional brain has taken over. Your tools are not accessible. So we're not operating from a clear mind from the get-go.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that's interesting about what you just said is I think that that whole idea of would you rather be right or would you rather be married or connected is, you know, I've only come to find out about that in the past, I don't know, 6 years or so. And I think that was a real game changer for me. And it's taken some time to kind of catch up. And I think I'm still kind of mastering that idea. But the idea there is we're not seeking to win the argument. What we're seeking to do is see, hear, and validate where our partner's coming from, to hear the emotions underneath their words and listen non-defensively, listen with curiosity,
or
and try and find out.
Not just words, or behaviors or actions, right? To see what's underneath even the behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
Could be. Just words.
And that's a really big mindset shift. Where I think if we could all do that, we would be so much better off. Because I think so many of us are, we get stuck in anger, and then we're just going to die on that hill to try and prove that we're right. And we're just arguing to get our partner to hear how right we are and admit how wrong they are, which is never going to happen.
Right.
Or rarely.
Right. So if you're listening to this and you're like, oh my God, you just described my relationship dynamics, which in fact, over this weekend, we were out at a comedy show, which was all about dating and relationships. And we were talking to this woman in front of us and she's like, oh, I've got two therapists here. I'm going to get some free therapy advice. And she, you know, kind of told us a little bit more about her most recent breakup. And as we shared our story, she was like, you just described exactly what my boyfriend and I went through. And it really gave us the impetus to record this episode specifically on anxious avoidance styles, because as John said in the beginning, it is one of the most common styles amongst couples to get stuck in. And there is a way out of it. And as you know, it's got to start with awareness that we're even in it. Mm-hmm. But it's got to be awareness with compassion versus awareness with judgment. If we have an awareness with judgment, it's going to continue to blame, externalize shame, and make us feel that this is fixed and we have no hope of getting out of it. awareness with compassion is the awareness of, wow, this is like really deeply rooted shit here.
And so let me share one of the ways that we got out of it, I believe, that was all you, just to give credit where credit's due. So a lot of times when we would get into disagreement, we would at some point come to a resolution and then put it behind us, or so I thought. And Jory became famous for kind of bringing up past disagreements 3, 4, 5, 7 days later. And we'd be on a walk or something. She said, "Hey, you know, I'm not quite settled on this. Would you mind if I brought it up again?" And at first I'm like, "Oh shit, like we got to talk about this again. Like we just nailed this one. We just put it to rest. I don't really want to have another uncomfortable conversation about this." And over time, I began to realize that this was a really effective way of changing our patterns in a way that mattered. Because every conversation that we had subsequent to the initial disagreement, we were more objective, more curious, less judgmental, and we had greater distance from it. So we could look at ourselves and our own dynamics and our own feelings in a more honest way, but also we were in a spot where we could offer gently suggestions to each other, which I think were far more likely to be heard and considered. And over time, this, I think of it now as an upward spiral of kind of revisiting these disagreements. And every time you go to the same point on the spiral, you're revisiting the same disagreement. But if you do that enough, you really come to some resolution in some of these areas where there was no resolution before.
Right. And I think the other thing that it gave us the ability to do, now this is the tricky part with this. And I know if you're listening, you're like, yeah, but if I bring it up again, we're going to get dysregulated. We're going to go right back to where we were. So I would lead with the intention of, hey, love, I don't want to get us re-triggered. I would like to be able to talk about what was underneath our argument. So when we can lead with the intention, it's a little bit easier to see where we might get off track with it, so we can bring it back to the intention. But it's a fear I hear, especially from women, of, I don't want to rock the boat. Why would I bring it back up? Well, we're not rocking the boat. We're simply trying to gain insight and we're trying to gain understanding, because we all, like you said, my favorite thing, we all want to be seen, heard, and validated. And if that emotional brain has taken over, there's no chance of it. And yeah. So the best chance we have of being seen, heard, and validated is talking about it when we're actually not triggered.
And how else do you look at what's underneath your anger? Because there's a saying, which I don't 100% agree with, but the saying is that anger is always a secondary emotion. I do think anger can be a primary emotion too. Like you just get angry about someone violating a boundary or treating you in a bad way or social injustices. And at the same time, I think anger is very frequently a secondary emotion, which means that it follows really quickly on the heel of another emotion, a primary emotion, or maybe several primary emotions. So especially in men, I've seen anger follow, and we're talking like a third of a second follow, but anger follow on the heels of embarrassment, guilt, shame, anxiety, and depression or sadness. Because we know depression in men shows up most often as irritability and impatience. Mm-hmm. So men, if you're male and listening to this, have the wisdom, have the curiosity to ask yourself, perhaps after the fact, what was underneath that anger? Like, what was I really feeling? Because think about times in your past when you've gotten embarrassed and it's quickly shot to anger.
So coming back to and revisiting those conversations, you know, you gave credit to where credit was due, saying that I kept doing this, but I really want to honor that. I'm going to give you the credit of being open to it and recognizing and getting out of the narrative that you had that this wouldn't help. So thank you for doing that. I think it was both of our efforts in stepping towards the relationship. And, you know, that's always the key is, how can we be relational right now? And that's what I struggled with, because the avoidant space didn't feel relational until I had to understand, no, this is the way to get back to being relational, is to get to that point of regulation to be able to come back together. But if a secure attachment is based on safety and trust, and an anxious or avoidant attachment is based on not feeling secure and not trusting your partner is going to be there, it's also going to build in all other areas in which we can build safety. And so not just, you know, the times in which we would revisit disagreements, but, and especially after our breakup, I think we've done an exceptional job over the course of the year to build safety in an authentic way in which we can really trust one another, having each other's backs. Mm-hmm. And that trust is built through small daily action, right? The Gottmans talk about, as one of the tools to become a master versus disaster in relationship, is small things often. Mm-hmm. So what are the small things you can do to make your partner feel safe and secure? Part of that's going to be non-defensive listening. Part of that's going to be validating their experience, even if you disagree or don't like it, right? The non-reactivity, the doing what you say you're going to do. If you're going to be back in 20 minutes, be back in 20 minutes. If you're going to text when you get somewhere, text, like all these little things, which many people feel like, oh, that sounds controlling, or that feels like I'm on a short leash, or do I have to be that transparent? Well, if you want a secure attachment, yeah, these are relational things.
Well, and to flip that, I mean, what do you ask of your teenager? You know, do you ask them to text you when you get to a, when they get to a party, for example? Do you ask them to text you when they get to a destination after driving an hour or two? To me, this is just consideration for people that you love. You don't want to have to worry about them. You want to know that they're safe.
And the way that you and I have done that with our teenage daughters is we flip the script. By we text them when we get somewhere, we let them know we are safe and say, look, this isn't about control of a top down. This is about respect for when you care for someone, you want to have that safety and trust. And, you know, repairing safety and trust after a transgression or a breach in safety and trust can be hard. At the root of that is, what is my mindset towards change? So, you know, if you have, John and I get asked this question all the time is, you know, what's the core thing to know if this is a relationship worth getting into or fighting for, is having that growth mindset towards learning the relational skills and being willing to grow and change. And part of that willingness, which I think, thank you for your growth, John, because this is something you've done very well at, is the willingness to stay uncomfortable for the purpose of ultimate connection. And I was just going to say, you know, it was a huge deal at the time when he realized he had a 15-minute window before getting flooded. Like, that was great self-awareness. And that he had a, that John, you had that awareness a couple of years ago. And yet that was still hard because sometimes you couldn't resolve everything in 15 minutes, or my emotions wouldn't feel settled within 15 minutes. So it was great awareness and didn't always lead to ease of resolution. And part of what built my safety and trust in our relationship was when we did a 12-hour, 6-hour per day, 2-day therapy intensive. Like, that was you standing in the fighting for the relationship, saying, hey, I'm willing to sit for 6 hours of therapy over the next 2 days. That was a willingness to be uncomfortable for the sake of relational connection. And I so valued that.
I thank you. And I like the idea of, you know, anytime you're in a relationship like this, there's three entities. There's you, me, and the relationship. And I like thinking of it like that because I think it helps me to fight for the relationship even when we are in disconnection. Because there's times in those moments when I don't like you that much, when I am angry at you, and I still know the relationship is exceptional.
Right.
And I think the idea of giving to the relationship, of meeting the needs of the relationship before oneself, I like the idea that paradoxically helps me to get my own needs met more frequently.
Well, absolutely. And that was something I struggled with as part of my narrative of my own past challenges and traumas, was finding individuation. And, you know, independence and individuation in a committed partnership. And when we met Terry Real last year at a conference, but also when I had him on the podcast, if you guys haven't heard that episode, it's really great. It came out a few months ago. And I asked him, you know, what is the right balance of individuality and relational connection in a partnership? And having his relational awareness, you know, and therapy, he said, well, if you are focusing on the relationship, a strong relationship will feed the individual. So everyone's needs will get met when you always turn towards the relationship. And the more you turn towards the relationship, that's what builds a secure attachment to give your partner more, I don't like the word, but I'll say it, more freedoms for their individuality because they're such a safe and secure base.
From which to explore the world.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, these are how we developed a safe and secure attachment with our primary partner, even despite what we had growing up or in a previous relationship. And I've seen with you, John, your worldview change, I would say, over the past year regarding someone can be trusted. Someone will be there for me. And that's allowed, from my perspective, for you to feel secure with me, mm-hmm. which also then feeds your worthiness. That was the fear and the underneath that was coming up when we don't have someone always there for us, right? And I would say, go ahead.
Well, and I think in my past, I had the experience and the history of getting burned, if not badly burned, by several females.
Right.
And so that was something I had to work on individually to overcome and in relationship.
Right. And I've seen you shift that beautifully. So thank you for the individual work that you've done to get there. It's quite courageous to be able to look at ourselves and get out of those narratives. And I don't think I've had a more accelerated growth path for myself than I have in the past 12 months. It's
absolutely
astonishing to see that with desire and capacity towards growth and connection, we can move mountains when it comes to what we can focus on our relationship. And, you know, that's some of the two key things that we talk about is having the desire and the capacity for growth and change. And when you are committed to the relationship you're in and things aren't working, we've got to figure out, you know, what do we need to get back to that point of safety, security, and connection?
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add?
No, I'm just aware of time and I've got to wrap up in a couple minutes.
So, you know, we want to share this as we do wrap up to normalize A, how hard relationships are. They're fucking hard. Mm-hmm. Love isn't enough. We are building out this new arm of our joint business together. We will soon be launching our new website, loveisn'tenough.net. We, are soon going to be launching a new Instagram account in which we are really focusing on this because people love each other and don't know how to be in relationship with each other. And it's causing a lot of pain for a lot of people. And the problem is they think, oh, I'll just end this relationship and go find someone else in which it's easier. But your attachment styles, your traumas, your belief systems, your narratives, your level of self-awareness and self-work is going to follow you wherever you go.
mm-hmm. Wherever you go, there you are.
Wherever you go,
and I think, you know, if you have a partner who is growth-minded, you have the opportunity to reparent yourself, to reprogram some of those old tapes, and then to use that romantic relationship truly to go out and explore the world from. Yeah. And so it offers this beautiful chance to heal your past and create a thriving, happy, fulfilling relationship.
Yeah. So if this is speaking to you, stay tuned for more from us. We do have our monthly masterclass series that covers a lot of this stuff. That link will be in the show notes if you'd like to join. Our upcoming one is happening on, I believe it's March 20th. And this is going to be all about awareness. So a lot of what we talked about here today around the self-awareness that we need to be able to show up in relationship may not always be evident to you of what we need to be aware of and how to practice that. And, you know, at the end of the day, change is possible. Growth is possible. It may not be easy. And you may have to have some breakdowns to lead to breakthroughs. And they don't always have to be breakups, but you know, what we needed was a complete shattering of our frameworks, both personally and relationally, to say, we love each other. Let's get rid of what wasn't working and understand how to build something to really work and to connect and to feel safe and secure in. So I can easily say, hey, I'm going to take a couple hours at home. I'll see you on later, and not feel threatened by space. And for me to do that easily, change and growth was possible.
Mm-hmm. Well done.
Yeah. And I attest all of that to the work that we've done, being so fiercely protective and committed to this relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So if this episode has spoken to you, we'd love a rating, a review, a share. And if you want to do more work with us, we are available for couples coaching as well. So be sure to send us a message. And, you know, we're in the business of helping people cultivate the relationship that they always dreamed of. You know, when you fell in love and you had that idea of what it was going to look like, and somewhere along the way, life got in the way, we want to help you get back to that spot, because we did it and it's never been better. And we know it's possible. It's going to take work, but the work is a journey. It doesn't have to mean it's hard. It's going to be hard, but it doesn't have to mean you can't do it. So thanks you guys for tuning in.
All right. Thanks guys.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman Podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.